This is January 26th, 2014. And today I'm going to kind of follow up from last week's Tay Show. Last week, I gave the title to it as The American Myth of Individualistic Independence. Could also have said the American myth of radical individualism or radical autonomy. And I read from a couple of New York Times articles about how deluded, basically, it is to think that we stand alone and are the architects of our own fate without relying on others, other people, other phenomena all the time, denying that we are embedded in a web of interdependence. Today, I want to go a step further and revisit a topic I've given, I think, two Tay Shows on over the years, which is the whole mysterious matter of free will. And both of these Tay Shows, this sort of shared topic, I'm doing now because after New Year's, I think there's just a general movement toward greater self-discipline and efforts to change one's habits. That's why we have a term intensive here in January to capitalize on that impulse to make more of ourselves, to reform ourselves. And then there comes the startling news about free will. This is also from the New York Times. You know, they're good. These Times writers are good synthesizers, are aggregators of stuff that are out there in the culture. It's called free will. Now you have it, now you don't. Now this is, I see as I look here that this was 2007, January 2nd, 2007. But the outline of it, the basic issues are not resolved, except in a Zen way. So we'll get to that. But now the author is Dennis Overby. Let's see what we can find out about him. Nothing. Okay, so he starts off. I don't know if anyone can relate to this, but he starts off saying, "I was a free man until they brought the dessert menu around." There was one of those molten chocolate cakes, and I was suddenly being dragged into a vortex, swirling helplessly toward caloric doom, sucked toward the edge of a black chocolate hole. Visions of my father's heart attack danced before my glazed eyes. My wife, Nancy, had a resigned look on her face. And then he says, "The outcome, endlessly replayed whenever we go out, is never in doubt, though I often cover my tracks by offering to split my dessert with the table." And then he gets into it. "Having just lived through another New Year's Eve, many of you have just resolved to be better, wiser, stronger, and richer in the coming months and years. After all, we're free humans, not slaves, robots, or animals doomed to repeat the same boring mistakes over and over again. As William James wrote in 1890, the whole sting and excitement of life comes from our sense that in it, things are really being decided from one moment to another, and that it is not the dull rattling off of a chain that was forged innumerable ages ago." And then he says, "Get over it, Dr. James. Go get yourself fitted for a new chainmail vest. A bevy of experiments in recent years suggest that the conscious mind is like a monkey riding a tiger of subconscious decisions and actions in progress, frantically making up stories about being in control. This is very similar to the analogy that was quoted by Freud, which we read this last week. The ego is like a man on horseback struggling to contain the powerful beast beneath. To the extent that the ego succeeds in guiding this beast, it's only by transforming the id's will into actions as if it were one's own. He goes on, Dennis Overby, as a result, physicists, neuroscientists, and computer scientists have joined the heirs of Plato and Aristotle in arguing about what free will is, whether we have it, and if not, why we ever thought we did in the first place. So, this has been going on, this argument has been going on for a very long time, and I remember encountering it in philosophy in college. It was just the issue was framed as free will versus determinism. It's one of these never-ending arguments. Is it an illusion? That's the question, said Michael Silberstein, a science philosopher at Elizabethtown College in Maryland. Another question, he added, is whether talking about this in public will fan the culture wars. And then he said in an email, if people freak at evolution, etc., how much more will they freak if scientists and philosophers tell them they are nothing more than sophisticated meat machines? And is that conclusion now clearly warranted, or is it premature? Daniel Dennett, a philosopher and cognitive scientist at Tufts University, who has written extensively about free will, said that when we consider whether free will is an illusion or reality, we are looking into an abyss. What seems to confront us is a plunge into nihilism and despair. Nihilism, I looked it up to be sure I was very clear about it. Nihilism is the belief that there is no meaning or purpose in existence. Philosophy, it's just slightly different. In philosophy, it's the denial of the existence of any basis for knowledge or truth. So that people may think of the void, which we touched on in last week's Taisho, and we will again in this one. Mark Hallett, a researcher with the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, said, free will does exist, but it's a perception, not a power or a driving force. People experience free will. They have the sense they are free. I think this is pretty good. This comes pretty close to the Buddhist understanding of it. Strictly speaking, we wouldn't say that anything exists flat out. That's just half of the story. We ourselves don't exist merely. It's not as simple as that. We do and we don't. Everything does and doesn't. But still, okay, there's a free will. We can speak of free will. But it's a perception. We experience it. But isn't that what matters? Isn't that the important point? Is our experience of it? I'll read more before I get into more thoroughly commenting on this. The more you scrutinize it, the more you realize you don't have it, he said. Right, because there's no one to have it. This is what is so radical about Zen and Buddhism and the experience of enlightenment is seeing that there is no one to have anything, which is the missing side of this whole debate about free will versus determinism. Are we free or are we determined? Well, there's no we. And yet, even that's just half of the truth. He goes on, that is hardly a new thought. The German philosopher Schopenhauer said, as Einstein paraphrased it, that a human can very well do what he wants, but cannot will what he wants. Einstein, among others, found that a comforting idea. This knowledge of the non-freedom of the will protects me from losing my good humor and taking much too seriously myself and my fellow humans as acting and judging individuals, he said. How comforted or depressed this makes you might depend on what you mean by free will. Of course, it always comes down to semantics. That's solidly in accord with Zen teaching and experience as well, is the limitations of words. What you mean by free will? The traditional definition is called libertarian or deep free will. It holds that humans are free moral agents whose actions are not predetermined. This school of thought says, in effect, that the whole chain of cause and effect in the history of the universe stops dead in its tracks as you ponder the dessert menu. At that point, anything is possible. Whatever choice you make is unforced and could have been otherwise, but it is not random. You are responsible for any damage to your pocketbook and your arteries. So this is the one extreme, that we are entirely free, and this is a denial of the law of causation. He continues, that strikes many people as incoherent, said Dr. Silberstein, who noted that every physical system that has been investigated has turned out to be either deterministic or random. Both are bad news for free will, he said. So if human actions can't be caused and aren't random, he said, it must be, what, some weird magical power? People who believe already that humans are magic will have no problem with that. But whatever that power is, call it soul or spirit, or we could say call it nothing, those people have to explain how it could stand independent of the physical universe and yet reach from the immaterial world and meddle in our own jiggling brain cells that lead us to say the words molten chocolate. A vote in favor of free will comes from physicists who say it is a prerequisite for inventing theories and planning experiments. And then the author here reviews the findings of Benjamin Libet, who in the 1970s, he was a physiologist at the University of California, who in the 1970s wired up the brains of volunteers to an electroencephalogram and told the volunteers to make random motions like pressing a button or flicking a finger while he noted the time on a clock. I know I've read this in Teisho before, but it is absolutely mind-blowing. Dr. Libet found that the brain signals associated with these actions occurred half a second before the subject was conscious of deciding to make them. The order of brain activity seemed to be perception of motion and then decision. rather than the other way around. In short, the conscious brain was only playing catch-up to what the unconscious brain was already doing. The decision to act was an illusion, the monkey making up a story about what the tiger had already done. Dr. Libet's results have been reproduced again and again over the years, along with other experiments that suggest that people can be easily fooled when it comes to assuming ownership of their actions. Patients with tics or certain diseases like chorea cannot say whether their movements are voluntary or involuntary. In some experiments, subjects have been tricked into believing they are responding to stimuli they couldn't have seen in time to respond to, or into taking credit or blame for things they couldn't have done. Take, for example, the voodoo experiment by Dan Wegner, a psychologist at Harvard, and Emily Pronin of Princeton. In the experiment, two people are invited to play witch doctor. One person, the subject, puts a curse on the other by sticking pins into a doll. The second person, however, is in on the experiment, and by prior arrangement with the doctors, acts either obnoxious, so that the pin sticker dislikes him, or nice. After a while, the ostensible victim complains of a headache. In cases in which he or she was unlikable, the subject tended to claim responsibility for causing the headache. An example of the magical thinking that makes baseball fans put on their rally caps. "We made it happen in a lab," Dr. Wegner said. Is a similar sort of magical thinking responsible for the experience of free will? And then this Dr. Wegner said, "We see two tips of the iceberg, the thought and the action, and we draw a connection. But most of the action is going on beneath the surface. Indeed, the conscious mind is often a drag on many activities. Too much thinking can give a golfer the yips. Drivers perform better on automatic pilot. Fiction writers report writing in a kind of trance in which they simply take dictation from the voices and characters in their head." And then he says, "A grace that is, alas, rarely, if ever, granted nonfiction writers." Naturally, almost everyone has a slant on such experiments, and whether or not the word illusion should be used in describing free will. Dr. Libet said his results left room for a limited version of free will in the form of a veto power over what we sense ourselves doing. In effect, the unconscious brain proposes and the mind disposes. This is very important in terms of term intensive commitments and just generally all of our best efforts to change. The unconscious mind brain proposes, so to whatever, skip sitting, or skip yoga, or skip exercise. That's the proposal, and then the conscious mind can veto that. And then the author points out that most of the Ten Commandments are do not orders. Indeed, the conscious mind is often a drag on many activities. Well, we know one where it can get in the way. And we do have veto power. Every time we catch the mind having wandered into thoughts, we do have a choice there of whether to veto the thoughts, just no, and going back to the practice, or not. That is our power. But it's a very, as to whether we have free will, it's really, again, a question of how you define it. We know that we have this immeasurable weight of habit force behind us, the habit that pulls us into our thoughts, the habit that draws us into reactivity toward people and situations, reacting out of greed, hostility, delusion. This is the stream of habit force that we are up against, that we're trying to swim up against. So we can't simply deny that it's there. And yet, at every given moment, there is a sense in which we are free. At that moment, even though we have this momentum at our back pushing us in the wrong direction, still, we, at that moment, we do have choice, at least veto power in what we do. There's the razor's edge. The law of causation that cannot be denied completely, the force of habit. And yet, in every moment, we are reborn. It goes right to a way of understanding emptiness in Buddhism is the evanescence of the self and all phenomena. That as soon as we say I, it's false because there's already change. There's a continuous, we are in continuous flux. There is no thing that we can say exists unchanged. No thing that has any substance to it. That is our freedom. There. The no thingness of things is our freedom. We're not stuck with a self and its habits. We may be pushed by these habit forces, but even those have no substance. Habit forces are energy, forms of energy, patterns of energy. That's not a thing. It's a no thing. It's nothing. I'll go back to the article. Dr. Dennett, the Tufts professor, is one of many who have tried to redefine free will in a way that involves no escape from the materialist world while still offering enough autonomy for moral responsibility, which seems to be what everyone cares about. The belief that the traditional intuitive notion of a free will divorced from causality is inflated metaphysical nonsense, Dr. Dennett says, reflecting an outdated dualistic view of the world. Rather, Dr. Dennett argues, it is precisely our immersion in causality in the material world that frees us. Evolution, history, and culture, he explains, have endowed us with feedback systems that give us the unique ability to reflect and think things over and to imagine the future. Free will and determinism can coexist. And then Dennett says, all the varieties of free will worth having, we have. We have the power to veto our urges and then to veto our vetoes, he said. We have the power of imagination to see and imagine futures. I touched on this in a Teisho last fall, leading up to Jukai, where I talked about the role of imagination in ethics and ethical decisions, where we have the power as human beings to imagine the consequences of our actions or our inactions. That itself, that power to imagine the consequences, is part of causation. It has to be. And at the same time, endows us with a very real kind of choice, free will. There's a book that came out in the, I don't know, maybe 5 or 10 years ago, by a science writer for Newsweek magazine at the time, Sharon Begley, called Train Your Mind, Change Your Brain, a groundbreaking collaboration between neuroscience and Buddhism. And it says how a new science reveals our extraordinary potential to transform ourselves. I'll just read the back. In the back of this book is this kind of a summary here. In this fascinating and far-reaching book, Newsweek science writer Sharon Begley reports on how cutting-edge science and the ancient wisdom of Buddhism have come together to reveal that, contrary to popular belief, we have the power to literally change our brains by changing our minds. Recent pioneering experiments in neuroplasticity, the ability of the brain to change in response to experience, reveal that the brain is capable of altering its structure and function and even of generating new neurons, a power we retain well into old age. What just happened in the Zen, though, is most likely fainting. And this happens every once in a while. It can be pretty debilitating temporarily. Let me reread this. Recent pioneering experiments in neuroplasticity reveal that the brain is capable of altering its structure and function and even of generating new neurons, a power we retain well into old age. This is one of the most positive, heartening books one could read. The brain can adapt, heal, renew itself after trauma, compensate for disabilities, rewire itself to overcome dyslexia, and break cycles of depression and OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. And as scientists are learning from studies performed on Buddhist monks, it is not only the outside world that can change the brain, so can the mind, and in particular, focused attention through the classic Buddhist practice of mindfulness. And I actually did a Teisho on this book, I think, a few years ago. But this is the next thing that the author gets into as far as trying to sort out this business between free will and determinism is the power of emergence. The last thing I said was read was we have the power to veto our urges and then to veto our vetoes. We have the power of imagination to see and imagine futures. And then it continues, in this regard, causality is not our enemy, but our friend, giving us the ability to look ahead and plan. That's what makes us moral agents, Dr. Dennett said. You don't need a miracle to have responsibility. And then it says that there are philosophers who question the extent to which collections of things, whether electrons or people, can transcend their origins and produce novel phenomena. These so-called emergent phenomena, like brains and stock markets, or the idea of democracy, grow naturally in accordance with the laws of physics, so the story goes. And then this Dr. Silverstein says, there's nothing in fundamental physics by itself that tells us we can't have such emergent properties when we get to different levels of complexities. So this is the wild card in all this, is that through evolution, let's use that word, through physical evolution, our brains become, and other complex forms become increasingly complex, and then transcend themselves. They have the power to transcend themselves and reach a whole different level. A George Ellis, a cosmologist at the University of Cape Town, said that freedom could emerge from this framework as well. Here he distinguishes between what is simply determined according by physical laws and what can then go beyond determinism. A nuclear bomb, for example, proceeds to detonate according to the laws of nuclear physics. Whether it does indeed detonate is determined by political and ethical considerations, which are of a completely different order. So we can make the case that as human beings, we are of a completely different order. We are determined to a great extent, and yet we have this ability to reflect and plan and envision and imagine and aspire to become free. This is why all of the Buddhist texts back to ancient times have called out the great, great privilege of being born with a human body-mind, because it is of a different order of possibility than other sentient beings. The death of free will, or its exposure as a convenient illusion, some worry, could wreak havoc on our sense of moral and legal responsibility. According to those who believe that free will and determinism are incompatible, Dr. Silverstein said in an email message, it would mean that people are no more responsible for their actions than asteroids or planets. Anything would go. And then he added, a system a bit more focused on helping people change rather than paying them back for what they've done might be a good thing. And then the article ends with Libet, this Dr. Libet, who first came up with these astounding results, quoting Isaac Basheva Singer, who once said in an interview with the Paris Review, the greatest gift which humanity has received is free choice. It is true that we are limited in our use of free choice. But the little free choice we have is such a great gift and is potentially worth so much that for this itself, life is worthwhile living. So yes, we are pushed and pulled by habit forces that we ourselves have laid down. But at any given moment, we have the possibility of laying down new circuits, new grooves. Every single time when we notice thoughts in the mind, every time we choose to go to no mind, that's the breath, the koan, whatever our practice is, every time we choose no mind over the stuff of the mind, we are changing the circuits. Karma, to use a Buddhist word. We're changing our karma every time. Every time we sit, cross our legs, and work at making this choice in the right direction, we're changing our karma. We are flux. In Zen, there is a koan, famous koan, in which this whole matter of free will versus determinism, versus causation, you could say, is tackled head on. It's number 2 in the Mumonkan, called Hyakujo and a Fox. And just to summarize it, whenever Hyakujo, he's a great Tang Dynasty Chinese Zen master, whenever he, I'll just make it simple. He would give teishos, and there was always one old man who stayed behind, or at least he appeared to be an old man. And then finally one day he said, "I may look like an old man, but actually I'm a fox." So this is the sort of the narrative device of the koan, is to play this out as an old man who was consigned to many rebirths as a fox because of incorrect teaching. He explained this fox man, fox monk, said that he was asked when he had been the abbot of that very monastery, and was once asked, "Can an enlightened man fall again under the chain of cause and effect or not?" And he had answered, "No." And for that, he was consigned to these many 500 rebirths as a fox. A fox is not seen as a fortunate life form in Zen. And now he found his way back to Hyakujo, who he had faith would be able to correct him, give him the right turning word on this. And so he put to Hyakujo the same question. "So, can the enlightened person fall again under the chain of cause and effect or not?" And Hyakujo answered, "He does not ignore the law of causation." Doesn't say he's free of causation. He doesn't say he's bound by causation. He does not ignore the law of causation. Another translation is he does not evade the law of causation. Another is he's not blind to the law of causation. And this released the fox abbot from his fox fate, and he became a monk again. And in Doksan, the the challenge for the student is to demonstrate physically their understanding of that statement. It does not ignore the law of causation. And in doing so, being able to leap free of the dualisms of free will versus determinism. Too many so-called enlightened teachers claim that they're free of causation, and they get into big trouble that way. Bodhidharma said, "One who thinks only that everything is void but is ignorant of the law of causation falls into everlasting pitch-black hell." And yet, we have this amazing gift of human intelligence. I don't mean IQ. Our human station, our ability to reflect and all that, and this is what gives us our freedom. In another koan in the Mumonkan, the very last koan, there's a verse, the last line that reads, "Although each move is ahead of the next, know that there's another way up." It's really the same issue. Although each move is ahead of the next, we do this, we become that, we sit more, we become more aware, more compassionate, more wise, we get more free of our afflictions, our habit forces, steadily, little by little. Yes, but no, there's another way up. From the very beginning, all beings are Buddha. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.